In 2014, John Kucera and Gary Orfield of UCLA's Civil Rights Project found that New York State has the nation's most segregated public schools, with over 90% of black students in the New York metro area attending majority-minority schools. As those public schools have become more segregated, New York City's most elite private schools are moving in the opposite direction. For example, Fieldston's lower school now has fewer than 50% white students. The rest are 20% black or Latino. Another 20% identifies as multiracial, and the remainder are Asian or won't say. But integration has not led to racial harmony, and so Fieldston's lower school is using new curriculum to try to combat misunderstandings. In this week's New York Magazine, veteran journalist Lisa Miller reports on the program in an article titled, "Can Racism Be Stopped in the Third Grade?" I am pleased it has brought her back to our show, so it's a pleasure to see you.
I'm very happy to be here.
And we invite our audience to join in this discussion. Were you aware that New York City's public schools are more segregated than ever? Although today's discussion is about one elite private school's attempt to surmount issues of race, have you had any experiences along these lines yourself? We'd like to hear from you. Our number is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Lendit Lopate. Lisa, you write that the principal of Fieldston's lower school sent out a form explaining the new curriculum on the Friday after winter break. What did it tell the parents?
Right, so it was attached to an email, and on the form, it looked sort of like a census form. There was a vertical list, and it said, "What race are you?" on the top, and then a bunch of check boxes, black, African-American, white, Asian, Pacific Islander,
multiracial,
Latino, Latina.
And then not sure.
I'm not sure.
And what were they trying to find
out? And so the idea was that the kids were to have a conversation with their parents ahead of time. What are we? And then go to school the next week and check a box. And from that form, the kids would be divided into racial groups for 45 minutes for over five sessions. And so the black kids would go with the black kids, and the white kids would go with the white kids, and the Asian kids would go with the Asian kids. And within those 45-minute groups, talk about what it was like to be a member of that race.
Were children allowed to opt out of the program?
Well, not sure. Evolved into an opt-out group, but they still had to have a racial discussion during that time.
The article you've written deals with the parents and how they reacted to the program. You write, "For many of the parents at Lower, this program violated the values that they'd learned back in their own elementary schools a generation ago. You just don't sort human beings by race."
Right. I mean, we have a very difficult history about racial marking and what segregation means. And there are a lot of Jewish parents at the school who felt that, you know, parents said to me, like, "Why don't you just put the yellow stars on the kids?" People talked about segregation and Jim Crow. People talked about the Japanese internment. We don't have a proud history of, you know, racial segregation. So the idea that this might be an experimental, progressive, pedagogical method really rubbed some people the wrong way.
And one of the Jewish parents who'd grown up in the South pointed out that the Ku Klux Klan considered Jews to be another racial group.
Entity,
Not white.
Right. I mean, a lot of the Jewish... I mean, Fieldston was founded by secular Jews. It has historically been a school that's predominantly Jewish. And a lot of the Jewish parents at the school really felt like, "Don't lump me in with the whites. We have a long history of persecution. We have a history as a minority group. You know, we aren't mainstream whites."
Although some black parents said, "When I walk into a room and I see you, you're white."
That's right. And at Fieldston, it's a difficult argument to make. I mean, Fieldston was founded by Jews, and, you know, they've been, it's been a predominantly Jewish culture for a really long time.
Now, were the parents concerned that their children were too young to be compelled to think about things like race?
Many parents were. I mean,
that's pretty young.
Eight-year-olds see race, so obviously. They can tell the difference between who's brown and who's lighter brown and who's darker brown and who's white. But they don't have a racial identity. They don't have, like, it's not freighted with culture and society and history and tribalism the way it is once they get to middle school. And so there are a lot of parents who said, you know, they're too young to shoulder all of this.
But it's my sense that if you are a white kid and you've been trained that everybody's equal, then you're going to just talk to the African-American kid in the same way you would speak to your white friends. But the African-American kids are very aware, much more aware of those differences.
I think that's right. I mean, I think everybody at that age is very innocent. And these friendships that they form at that age are real. They're genuine, authentic, intimate friendships in a school this small. Lots of cross-racial friendships happen. But it is also true that a lot of the African-American families and a lot of the families of color felt that they were guests at this school and they wanted to feel more like the school belonged to them. They were members of the community equally.
Most of the children you quote who were involved in the program found it boring.
Well, not most, but one of them definitely did. You know, one of the aspects of the program that we didn't talk a lot about in the story was that it's third, fourth, and fifth graders together in racial groups. And I found talking to the children that the way a third grader talks about race and the way a fifth grader talks about race is entirely different.
The affinity groups were intended to some degree to boost self-esteem?
Well, yes. I mean, I think a lot of the families of color feel like, as I said earlier, you know, they don't want to feel like they're guests at a majority white school. They want to feel ownership. And so the idea is to get kids of the same race together to talk about what it's like to be a member of that race and to talk about their experience at the school.
Isn't there an equal danger of alienated whites from the minorities?
Well, I mean, I think especially with this controversy going on, you know, how divisive the program would have been had the parents not freaked out about it is an open question. It is definitely true that the groups have caused divisions in the community, but it's hard to know what would have happened if the parents had been chill.
The program claims that it would foster interracial empathy by encouraging children to recognize differences without disrespect. How is that going to happen?
Well, the idea is that in your racial groups, you can raise a lot of the issues that might be hot if you raise them in mixed race groups. So you can talk about why you're embarrassed or what you can talk about what you're curious about, or you can talk about what makes you uncomfortable and what makes you mad. And that's a safe place to have those conversations. Just the way, you know, boys and girls separate to talk about sex when they're young. You can have the blush-making conversations in separate gender groups. And then you get back and you have together and you have a different kind of conversation.
And that makes sense. But on the other hand, isn't it possible that this would lead to some discussion of stereotypes that might only be reinforced by their peers?
I think the whole idea is to talk about stereotypes. And I did observe a mixed-race discussion after the racial groups took place. And in that discussion, they talked about the kinds of stereotypes that you feel when you're a member of a racial group. So the Asian kids said, you know, when you're Asian, people are really confused about what religion you are. And we want to say that when you're Asian, you could be any religion. You could be Christian, you could be Muslim, you could be Hindu, you could be Buddhist. So it is a place for people to unpack the stereotypes and then share them with their peers.
My guest is Lisa Miller, who's written an article for the current issue of New York Magazine, entitled Can Racism Be Stopped in the Third Grade? She is currently a contributing editor at New York Magazine, formerly a senior editor at Newsweek and a religious columnist for The Washington Post. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Since you brought up religion, was that, and this is something that you have written about in the past, was that something that became a major component in the discussions?
No, I mean, it's a religion story only in that it's about people's deepest held values and the things that they feel deeply without necessarily examining them. In that way, it's a religion story.
What kind of training did the staff receive in preparation for meeting with these children?
There was a new, she's the head of multicultural and progressive education. Her name is Mariama Richards, and she had been there for about 18 months before she rolled out the program.
And she's an African-American.
She's African-American, and she's been doing this work for a long time. She was previously at Georgetown Day School. And she trained members of the current members of the Fieldston staff and teaching staff to mediate these conversations. In the ideal form of this program, the kids are leading the conversation and the teachers are there to mediate and direct, not to impose.
I'm assuming that the math and science teachers are less accustomed to this type of class discussion.
Yeah, there was a lot of controversy about the qualifications of the people who were facilitating the groups, which was unpacked a little bit in a Wall Street Journal article that came out a couple months ago. But, you know, the Richards trained these people to have these conversations.
I would assume that just equally productive might be to separate them according to economics, because there might be a lot more affinity between a wealthy African-American kid and a wealthy white kid or a Latino or whatever the other way around.
I did say in one of my interviews with one of the Fieldston administrators, you know, if you really want to have hot conversations, let's talk about how I feel when I go to your house and how you feel when I go to my house, because obviously the economic disparity at that school is profound.
And I'd imagine that that leads to tension sometimes if one kid thinks that everybody brings a good lunch and some kids are too poor to even bring a lunch.
Right. I mean, race is only one aspect of identity, and the people at the school acknowledge that, concede that. This is the aspect of identity that they've decided to unpack to this extent.
We have invited our audience to join the conversation. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And let's go to Vince from, is that Denver, Colorado, Vince?
Yes, indeed. I'm calling from out here on the frontier.
Okay. Well, our schools, well, first of all, I'd assume that Denver does not have as large a minority population as New York does.
That's correct. Although I believe, if I'm not mistaken, back in the 70s, in the early 80s, it was considered one of the most integrated cities in the country because it was a very small population here, but the black population, which has been here since, you know, Reconstruction, was significant and very powerful. You know that Wellington Webb was a mayor out here back, I think, one of the first black mayors of a predominantly white city.
And what did you want to tell us about, well, what are your thoughts about this conversation?
Well, I am a 1981 grad of Fieldston. I went from kindergarten through 12th grade, and I grew up in South Bronx. I was blessed to go to Fieldston because, and this I told this story at Founders Day, which is a gathering of all the schools back in 1981. In any case, the story that I told is that the reason my parents sent me to Fieldston was that when I was of school age, my sister's 4 years older, they saw that the South Bronx schools in our neighborhood were starting to fray because of white flight, et cetera. And they started looking at private schools. They went to Dalton, Trinity, you know, the whole crew, and they just didn't feel at home. It was 1968, the year that the folks who were charged with killing the three civil rights workers in Neshoba, Mississippi, were on trial, and they found out that Goodman and Schwerner, the two Jewish young men, were from New York and were members of Eskimo culture, and that just changed everything for them. They said, that's where we're going to send our kids. They sent me there and my sister 4 years later, and or 1 year later. And I was blessed to be president of the student body in 1981, and I said, this is what Fieldston embodies. This is what this school is about. 1981, we just elected Ronald Reagan. He gave his acceptance speech in Neshoba, Mississippi. He talked about states' rights. It's all about Southern strategy, you know, dog whistle politics.
Was Fieldston in those days, was it conscious of integrating itself?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know.
So this goes back a long time.
Yeah, long, yeah, proud history of this, yeah.
Right. In 1972, the Black Students Group took over the administration building, you know, motivated by what they saw at Columbia and some other schools. And here's a high school where the young people took over the administration building to demand more diverse teachers and more diverse curriculum.
And they won.
So, yeah, and they won. Yeah. They won. But, you know, it's always been a struggle. And I think that Fieldston has recognized that we've always had to struggle to make the myth of America real. And part of that myth is that everybody gets along and we don't see color. And in order to make that a reality, you actually have to recognize that people do see color and are judged by color at 3 years old, at 8 years old. And I think it's a very, very good program to actually acknowledge that and not say that it's a bad thing, but actually develop ways of relating on that basis and dealing with each other in the way that society has already imprinted on us.
Thank you so much for calling us, Vince. Another listener wonders whether we can't say that racism is learned. So would this program be intended to unlearn any possible racism that the kids might be have been affected by?
Yeah, so one of the interesting things about this particular age is that kids are the least racist at 8, 9, 10 years old than they ever will be and that they've ever been, because preschoolers, they're not exactly racist, but they're obsessed with color difference, and they want to know, like, who's black, who's white, who's tan, who's pink, who's beige, who's chocolate. You know, they make these distinctions. They
and
want to
why?
Talk about them. Because there's at that developmental age, they're sorting their world, and they're putting things into categories. But also, quietly, they're absorbing all the lessons of a racist culture. And so at 8, 9, 10, they become very interested in equity and in justice, and they want to talk about things like that. They form fresh friendships across race. They see race, but they don't attach value to it. And so the idea of this program and programs like it is to intercept the development of sort of tribal racial stereotypes and bias that happens by the time you're in middle school. And to sort of say at this very fresh age, like, let's talk about this stuff that you're learning without even acknowledging that you're learning it, without even knowing that you're learning it, so that when you have to navigate cross-racial relationships later and dating and locker rooms and workplaces and bosses and job interviews and college applications and all of those things that can be very fraught, you have some vocabulary and you have some comfort with these ideas.
Let's take a call from Roy from Roosevelt Island. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. I have a very unusual perspective on this development. First of all, congratulations to the writer and congratulations to Fieldson for the work that they're doing. I happen to have had an ex-wife who of African American who was at the Dalton School in 1957. And the atmosphere then was quite different than it is now. Yes, they had four or five black students, but they were there to make the white contingent of the school feel good about how they were helping these other people. And they always felt as if they were like some sort of exotic flower and never really got integrated into the school. I happen to have now twin boys who are at Dalton, and it is an entirely different school. They are aggressively pursuing a program of diversity, and whereas in my ex-wife's time, if you were black, you were a black carbon copy of the white contingent. In other words, they were affluent students, and they were in the same, they could have been in the same socioeconomic stratum, but they weren't because they were black. So that if you were a black doctor, you didn't associate in the same groups that white doctors did. But now the spectrum is totally diverse, not only in terms of race, but in terms of income. And the school as a whole has taken on a very aggressive look at, seems similar to Fieldston, examination of the hidden agenda that is institutionalized in our society, and we are blind to. We say we are liberal, but yet we are not, or most people, I happen to be African-American myself, but most people are not aware of the fact that if you're white, you're automatically white privileged, and you're not seeing the world the same as an African-American is seeing it. And to break that down is to get to that hard layer of of institutional racism that is just as strong here in the North as it is in the rest of the country. And I really am excited and enthusiastic and congratulate what private schools or the independent schools like Dalton and Fieldston are doing. And I think it'll make a big difference because these kids are going to be the leaders of tomorrow and they can make a difference.
Thank you so much for calling us, Roy. Before we go to a break, Lisa, were most of the African-American parents happy with this new program?
So one of the really interesting things about this parent body is that it is as diverse as the kids. And the opponents and the supporters did not break down wholly along racial lines. So I spoke to many parents who were variously brown-skinned who opposed the program. And I spoke to several parents who were white who really actively supported it.
And when we come back, we'll find out what those arguments were and, of course, take some more calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can also write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. My guest is Lisa Miller, currently a contributing editor for New York Magazine, and her article in the current issue of that magazine is Can Racism Be Stopped in the Third Grade? We're back with Lisa Miller, who is a contributing editor for New York Magazine. Her article in the current issue of that magazine is Can Racism Be Stopped in the Third Grade? Before we go to Fieldston for another moment, to put things in perspective, let's talk about what we began with, the kind of segregation that we see in New York's schools. Now, in the elite schools, it can get really out of hand. For example, out of the 962 eighth grade students who received offers to matriculate into Stuyvesant High School this year, in 2014, 7 are black and 21 Hispanic. Of the 968 eighth graders who've been admitted to Bronx High School of Science, 18 are black and 50 are Hispanic.
Yeah, I mean, there is no question that the tangle of race and achievement is an absolute disaster in New York. And that it is or should be a priority for all educators to figure out how to fix this.
Well, what does Fieldston hope to do ultimately here? Okay, these are kids who are 8, 9, 10 years old, and then they're going to go on into a complicated world. Is it assumed that they will enter it with a lot more wisdom than other kids, especially the kids who are going to public schools?
Yeah, I mean, as one of the callers said, you know, Fieldston thinks of itself as a standard bearer in progressive education. It educates the best and the brightest. Those people go on to prominent careers, hopefully in some of them in justice and in policy and in politics and in education. And, you know, if they've been taught to think about these things in a productive way from a young age, that they will, you know, lead the way.
What about the other elite schools, Friends Seminary, Collegiate Schools, St. Anne's, the Spence School?
They're all doing something.
The Montessori's.
They're all doing something, especially the progressive ones. I mean, there are national programs. The Southern Poverty Law Center started an online curriculum last year, which is sort of for public school teachers who don't have the luxury of sort of designing their own anti-racism, anti-bias curriculum, where you can download it off the internet. And since September, 16,000 public school teachers have downloaded this curriculum. So the Anti-Defamation League has a program, Human Rights Campaign has a program. They're all trying to go into schools and help people figure out how to do this.
What about the New York Board of Ed? Are they paying attention? After all, you write, every year an increasing number of New York City private schools select students to attend the White Privilege Conference founded 16 years ago by Eddie Moore Jr., the former diversity director at Brooklyn Friends. And this year, the theme of the conference organized by the Dalton School is Race, Privilege, Community Building. I would think that the New York Board of Education should be attending that, considering the fact that we have such segregated schools.
There are definitely departments in the Board of Ed who are looking at this. I think, you know, the vanguard of this work is in the independent schools and in the foundations, just because they have the money and the time and the personnel to deal with it.
At the same time that Filston is breaking out into affinity groups, the New York Times reported in February that private schools are tackling issues of white privilege by asking white students and faculty members to examine their own race and to dig deeply into how their presence affects life for everyone in their school communities, with a special emphasis on the meaning and repercussions of what has come to be called white privilege.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things...
Do these things ever achieve anything, or are they just simply kind of feel-good exercises?
I think that's a good question. I think that's a legitimate question. I think they will achieve some things sometimes with some people and not with others. One of the things that distinguishes Fieldston's program is that, you know, affinity group programs in elementary schools across the country tend to focus on the kids of color, so, and they tend to be optional. So if the kids of color want to join when they can after school, what distinguishes Fieldston is that the white kids have to join, which means that the white kids have to be in this conversation about race. You're not talking about racism with just half the people.
You write about one parent at Fieldston, Ben Hort, who in February posted a petition online protesting the program and citing possible irreparable harm to the kids. He argued, among other things, that the program might introduce a victim mentality to some children who might otherwise have dreamed of it, and by extension, a sense of guilt to others. Does he have a point?
Well, this goes to the question that you asked at the top of the show, which is, you know, does introducing these categories make kids more divided? And, you know, there's also this very firmly held belief, especially among some of the immigrant parents at Fieldston, in the American dream. So it doesn't matter what color my skin is. I can come here. I can mix in. I can blend in. My kid can get a great education. A lot of parents said to me, you know, I came from a place where my race really mattered, and I chose Fieldston because my kids weren't going to be confronted by the same kind of racism that I was. So, you know, will a program that goes on for five sessions for 45 minutes each do irreparable harm? I kind of doubt it. But it's a legitimate question whether, you know, these divisions aren't exacerbated by affinity groups.
So perhaps parents like Ben Hort are overreacting when he sends out a letter to parents and says, the discussion of race should certainly be part of our children's education, but segregation of any kind is regressive and separate is not equal as defined by the Supreme Court in 1954.
Yeah, I think...
You're really talking about a few classes and kids being able to speak out without feeling that they're going to be self-conscious because they're going to be judged by kids of another group.
I think it's really, really hard for white liberals to comprehend just how damaging colorblindness feels to people of color and how dehumanizing it feels. So this thing that liberals like to do, which is we are all the same, we are all equal, this talking about justice on an intellectual level and never talking about the visceral human feelings that we have when we're with each other in a room or the things that drive us apart, I think that has been under the surface for liberals for a really long time.
I was the president of the jazz club at Brooklyn College many years ago, and one of the things we noted was when all of our friends from the club were having lunch, the black kids sat with other black kids, and the white kids sat with other white kids, and at one point, one of the white kids asked a friend of one of the black kids, why don't you ever sit with us? He said, well, all you want to do is talk about race.
Right. I mean,
we want to talk about other things.
One of the things that the African American parents have complained about at Fieldston is this feeling that they have felt in white settings and that they are worried that their kids feel of having to explain all the time. Like, let me tell you how it is for a black person when blah, blah, blah. Or when in class, you know, a subject related to race comes up and everybody in the class looks at the black kid. Like, that's not a fulfilling experience.
And black journalists object to that, too, where if there's a story that involves race, they're most likely to be assigned to cover it.
Right. And so the idea is, like, that's one of the impulses for separating the kids out, so that kids don't have to explain themselves to the group constantly, that they can have their own conversation.
Let's take another call. Justin from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes, Justin.
Hi, it's great to be on the show. Thanks for having my call. I just wanted to say that I think the program is a great idea. And I think it's important to remember that it is just an exercise. I think it's really important to grab the minds of young people when they're really young, because the real world is going to present many other opportunities that can potentially shape their thinking along racial lines. It reminds me of an experiment the teacher did in the 60s. There's a documentary about it. I believe it's called A Class Divided. And the children were separated based on eye color or hair color. It's really interesting. If you haven't heard of it, you should check it out. I also wanted to say that I think it's a really good idea to include the white students. I think often in these cases, there can be a really prevalent sense of otherness for any non-white students taking part in these experiments or even in discussions. And, you know, one thing that people might think is potentially hazardous is that it might induce a premature sense of guilt in some of the white students. But it could happen, but I think that is necessary because for people who do identify as being parts of subordinate groups, like minority groups, it's something that they feel all the time, a feeling of otherness. And that comes with self-examination, that comes with being a part of another group.
And Justin, there's a body of research by social psychologist Claude Steele and others that shows how black kids on white college campuses fail to achieve their potential at times because they internalize stereotypes and, feeling impotent and isolated, cannot break out of the boxes to which society has them consigned. So, Lisa, where do we go from here? It seems like the public schools are segregated, the private schools are more integrated, but misunderstanding is rife in both instances.
Right. I mean, I think this question of boxes is really interesting. And it was a question that I kept coming back to as I was reporting and writing the story. Are these boxes salient? Do we all exist in boxes? And is the point of the exercise to acknowledge that, to inhabit the boxes, to own them, and to say, you know, I'm white, and this is how it feels to be white in this society? Or are we post-box somehow, which is something that a lot of the parents at Fieldston believe, which is, you know, we're increasingly multiracial, we're increasingly marrying and having children with people who don't look like us. The kids at Fieldston get along, you know, without any intervention, they have cross-racial friendships. You know, why are we imposing these categories on little children? And I think you look at this trans movement now, which is so post-box, you know, we don't live within the categories that society has established for us. And I think it's a real question of how you want to frame your identity and what matters to you. But as the previous caller said, this was an exercise.
Part of the real problem here is that this may be great, but we really won't know if it succeeded or not because each of us is an individual. Life goes on. Other things happen. You move to Mississippi, and then you're faced with a whole bunch of other
circumstances. That's right, and you don't know who you're going to marry, and et cetera, yeah.
Lisa Miller's article in the current issue of New York Magazine, where she is currently a contributing editor, is Can Racism Be Stopped in the Third Grade? And Lisa, it's always a pleasure having you on our show.
Nice to be here, Leonard. Thank you.